Business Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This week on Office Hours, Annette LaRoe, who was at the University of Minnesota a few weeks back to give a talk at the Sociology Department's annual Sociological Research Institute, which is really way more like a conference with a big party at the end than that name implies, let me say. But anyway, while LaRoe was in town, Kaya Heise and Jack Lamb had a chance to chat with her about her current research on how parents decide where to live and where to send their kids to school, and on the success of her best-selling book, Unequal Childhoods, as well as giving us a preview of the forthcoming second edition. So listen up for Office Hours with Annette LaRoe.
All right, so Professor LaRoe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, we just want to get started, maybe talk about your new research a little bit. I know tomorrow you're going to talk about it for a long time, but if you could maybe just give the listeners of the podcast a little overview of what you're doing.
Yes, in my current project with Elliot Weiniger, who is an associate professor at SUNY Brockport, we've been looking at how parents decide where to live and the role that schools play in that decision. Many of the studies of school choice really presume it's a rational decision, but in some of the families we've interviewed, the upper middle class families appear to, especially the white families, rely on thin and sketchy information from their networks. So even people who are researchers often don't do research, but they'll say everybody knows that this is a good neighborhood, so they move there. And so people often rely on informal information, which is sort of like in the air, that people just know that this is a good school or not. And then they'll go there, but when you ask them, well, what do you mean by a good school? Sometimes they'll talk about the social class and race characteristics of the students, but they won't really talk about the school itself.
Okay. And what age group are these kids?
These kids are getting ready to go into kindergarten, so they're little
kids. Oh, so it's first school.
Yeah, it's their first school. And we're interested in how people decide where to live. And for some people, the school decision and the home decision are fused together. So they'll buy a house because they hear it's good schools.
Okay.
And they'll move out of a neighborhood. They won't consider another neighborhood because they say the schools aren't any good there. And so for some people, but not all people, school decisions are tied to home decisions.
Okay.
That's really interesting.
So you're mainly finding that this isn't something where they really do a lot of research. They're really just from word of mouth and what their friends say.
That's right.
Picking these really big decisions.
That's right.
Okay. And how did you get interested in this?
Well, I'm interested in social class and the transmission of an advantage. And one of the most important ways that happens is through wealth, which is through home ownership. And so I was interested in how people decide where to buy a house, because for most Americans, it's the biggest source of wealth they have is their home. Yeah. And so I was interested in that, and then I was interested a lot of the literature. Most kids in public schools, most American children do go to public schools. It's you know, there are fewer kids in public schools than used to be. There are now kids in charter schools and private schools, but private schools still, you know, it's only 11% to 13% of the population. It's not a lot of kids are in private schools, though it's more in the cities, obviously. And then I know other people. Sal Saperito and Rob Warren here in Minnesota, now they're doing a study where they're looking at attendance boundaries. And it turns out that school attendance boundaries are different than zip codes. And so a lot of the quantitative work in trying to understand schools have used census data, not using attendance boundaries, but just census data. So now they're trying to get better quality data from the census, and they have a project. It's called SABIN, School Attendance Boundaries Information, and I think it's now going to live at the POP Center here at Minnesota.
Great.
And so I was just interested more generally in how people decide where to live and what kind of benefits they're trying to get for their kids in deciding on a neighborhood.
And how are you mainly doing this research?
I'm doing it through a number of different ways. I'm doing mostly in-depth interviews. I wanted to do observations, but turns out I've interviewed realtors, and they say that people show up at their real estate office already having decided on a neighborhood.
Okay.
We chose three suburban elementary schools that were really had different social class composition of the neighborhood around the school. And then we got permission to go to the schools, and from there we recruited parents. And we've been doing interviews with parents.
Okay.
But it turned out kindergarten was too late, because I was afraid if we did it earlier, they wouldn't know what they're going to do. But now we're trying to interview people with little kids, like three-year-olds, because those people seem to worry about it more. By the time they're in kindergarten, it's all retrospective data.
Sure.
So it feels like I'm either too late or too early in studying it.
So we wanted to talk about unequal childhoods and mm-hmm. how in our context did a kind of a study of bestsellers, kind of redoing the GAN study, sociology bestsellers, and unequal childhoods was a big one on there. Mm-hmm. Lots of classrooms use it. Mm-hmm. And when you wrote that book, I mean, did that success surprise you, or is that something you intended for when you were writing it?
No, it surprised me a lot. It's published by University of California Press, and it's actually one of their top 10 paperback sellers for the press as a whole. And I wrote it because I wanted to write a book that was similar to the books I liked to read when I was a kid, when I was in college. Yeah. Like Tally's Corner, I think, is a really good classic work that not that many people read. All Our Kin by Carol Stack. I wanted to write a book where the people were interesting, and you felt like you knew the people, but after reading the book. So I actually didn't think it was going to help my career. I thought it was going to be a book that would be used for sociology courses, hopefully. So I was surprised that it excuse me, has done well, and now I have a second edition, which is coming out in 2011, where I did a follow-up study 10 years after the original study, and I interviewed the young people, and I was able to track down all 12 young people, which was actually quite a feat to find them all. And I interviewed them, and I did separate interviews with most of their mothers and most of their fathers, and usually one sibling, if there was a sibling, to find out how their lives had unfolded in the decade after I did the original study.
How did you track them down? How did you go about that?
Most of the families, I sent a Christmas card to the families with, it used to be $5 tucked into it, but now it's $20. And so... For most of them, I had an address, but some of them I'd lost. They moved a lot, and I tried to find a relatives who then put me in touch with them.
Okay. And we also understand that your work has been picked up by the media as well. I'm referenced by New York Times columnist David Brooks, and so we're just wondering, you know, beyond the university press, how has your book on Unequal Childhoods been received by, I guess, more broader public?
Well, it is true that David Brooks wrote a column about it. And also Malcolm Gladwell in his book Outliers describes it. And Brooks also describes it in his new book, The Social Animal. Okay. He also discusses it. And, you know, it's a great honor to have people read it. Some people read it in reading groups, novel reading groups, because it's about parenting and it's about social class differences in parenting. And the argument is that middle-class parents see their children to be a project, and so they try to develop their talents and skills through reading use, through language use and time use, organized activities, and also intervention in institutions such as doctor visits or schools. While working-class and poor parents who love their kids just as much use scarce resources to take care of them, but then they presume that they will spontaneously grow and thrive. So rather than answering questions with questions, they give directives. Rather than putting them in organized activities, the kids watch TV, they hang out, they play with their cousins. And when it comes to schools, the parents turn over responsibility to the institutions, and they depend on the institutions. So I call this, using a gardening analogy, actually, the middle-class children I call concerted cultivation, the working-class children and poor children, I call the accomplishment of natural growth, because it's a lot of work. The parents are accomplishing something really important, but then they'll presume that they'll spontaneously grow and thrive. And the middle class children get a benefit, not because of the intrinsic value of the activities, but because they're complying with the standards of dominant institutions, which are changing all the time. The standards are changing all the time. So some people, like David Brooks, he wrote a beautiful summary of it in 600 words. By the end, he concluded that the middle-class kids outcompeted the working-class and poor kids, which was really not the thesis of the book. So I think, as in lots of things in life, people read it and they can come away with different interpretations. And so I think one of the important things in doing public sociology is to try it. I believe in sociology. I believe the sociologists have a lot of really important insights, much more than, say, economists, who don't really look at behavior for the most part. But I think at some level you have to do your best to get the work out there. And, you know, I think universities will do press releases and they'll try. I think it's important to share it. And reporters are so busy that the reporters from the New York Times will actually tell you this. They'll say, it's really helpful when an author calls us up and says, you know, I see you've been writing about these articles on this topic. This is what I've done research on. Yes. And I'm like, you're kidding. This seems like what a rewarding chutzpah here. But they say, oh, no, it's very helpful because, you know, they when they call you up, often they need that their deadline is the next day or that night. I mean, often they have a very quick time frame.
Right.
So I think you have to do your best to share the results, but then I think you also have to let go of expectation that you can control how it's used in the press.
Yes, and it sounds like your current project on redistricting, it's following up on a conversation, maybe that's going on in the public right now, but for those of us who may not know as much, can you talk about, if that is the case, about your current project, I suppose?
Yes, one aspect of the project is that in upper middle class communities, sometimes they have to redraw boundaries and change the number of children who attend one high school versus the other. And in upper middle class communities, though it seems not in working class communities, often there's an uproar.
Yes.
And parents are highly protective of their children and they don't want their children to have 8 more minutes on a bus.
Yes.
And they'll storm the school board and they'll protest and they'll have marches and they'll hire lawyers and there'll be lawsuits. And sometimes the schools will back down. So it's a problem because a lot of the research on parent involvement keeps stressing how positive parent involvement is. But really, there are drawbacks for parent involvement, particularly for school administrators in upper middle class communities. And there, the parents can really thwart them. One district I studied wanted to build a high school. And there was a park that was empty that was across the street from the high school. And the district would have saved $10 million in taxpayer dollars, around $2,000, I mean, in the year 2000, if they had built the new school across the street on the park and then tore down the old school and made the park across the street.
Mm.
Well, there were 12 houses lining the park, and they had a lawsuit, and it didn't happen, you know. So this sort of not in my backyard. But a lot of these upper middle class parents are able to activate a lot of resources, which I would call cultural capital, which are able to yield profits in their daily lives.
So getting back to the update of unequal childhoods,
mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in when you're doing these updates. What did you learn? What surprised you about where these kids were 10 years later?
Well, one of the surprises of unequal childhoods was that even though the families were very different, they were often only 30 minutes away from one another by car. They all felt like home. They all felt comfy. And after you got there, they felt comfortable to be there. And so some of them had wood paneling and other of them lived in low-income housing project with roaches crawling up the wall. I mean, they were all very different in terms of their facilities, in terms of how they raised their kids, but they were all home, they were all comfortable, they were all family. And I think it's common for kids growing up to think that their family's normal, and then when they get older, they see the variety in families. But it was hard to do the study because if you saw two families in one day, I always felt like I got a headache. Like the inequality, the gaps in people's lives were so profound. And then you would double your field notes. You'd have to write field notes for, often we'd write field notes for 5 hours after every 2-hour visits. And then if you did two visits in one day, then you doubled your field notes, which really was difficult to write that many notes for that many hours. And so 10 years later, the gaps had really widened. Because the middle class kids, I mean, what was on the line then was the whether or not kids, how kids spent their time, whether or not they watched TV or not. A lot of middle class kids' parents had rules. Kids didn't always necessarily follow them, but they had rules limiting TV in many of the middle class families. So Alexander Williams, a black middle class kid, has a piano lesson at 8:15 on a Saturday morning because his mother really doesn't want him watching TV. And she doesn't want to have a fight about it every Saturday morning either. Well, working class and poor family said, oh, I learned so much about TV. TV was on all the time. There were multiple TVs. They didn't have the same hostility to TV that middle class kids did, parents did. But 10 years later, it wasn't about TVs. It was about college. It was about, did you fulfill the classes you needed to fill to apply to college? Did you know how to apply to college? There's a lot of informal information about college attendance. Like, you have to have a fit. So there was one girl who didn't appear in the book named Tara Carroll, who graduated from a city high schools and had test scores that were that'd be the equivalent of about 1,000 out of 2,400 in today's SAT system, which is a typical score in a large urban district.
Sure.
So she applied to a lot of colleges, and her mother said, I leave it at school. It was between her and her counselor. And she applied to colleges where the SAT range was more like 1,500 to 1,800. So she didn't have a good fit between her... And if she was my daughter, probably I could have gotten her into a college. I could have found a college with a program for kids who had learning disabilities and gotten her placed. But I would have had to have a lot of informal knowledge about what kind of college to apply to, how to go about it, how to take her skills and package it, maybe do an extra year or something. And so it's not just about wanting to succeed and trying to succeed. She applied to 7 colleges. She got rejected from all of them. And she went to community college. And then it was a lot faster for her, and she wanted to be a nurse. And she didn't. The textbook was $113, and she didn't have the money. And she bought. And then she stopped going, but she didn't withdraw from the class. She didn't know she could withdraw, so she failed the class. You know, so little things become big things in the transition to adulthood.
Sure.
And so, middle class kids, I think, have cumulative advantages because there are little things that their parents intervene with, which end up them becoming big things because they avoid problems, or if there are problems, they repair the problems. And so middle class children benefit in countless ways from their parents' intervention, but those are very hard to capture on a survey because a survey by definition has to have standard answers and standard questions. And so how do you know that, you know, finding the money to buy an anatomy textbook or telling your kid to go see an advisor to drop a course?
Right.
Those are the things which really make a difference in preventing problems, but those are hard to capture in a survey.
As you're talking now, it really reminds me of the 7-Up project in the UK. And speaking of which, are you thinking of maybe following these kids even more later on in life and seeing?
I don't know the answer to that entirely, but as I explained in the second edition of the book, which University of California is doing, I've added 100 pages to the book. Some of the families were fine with the follow-up, with the book. I gave them each a copy of the book. But in some cases, the book really hurt their feelings. And so because of that, I'm no longer in contact with all the families.
Okay.
So like Alexander Williams' family, the black middle-class boy, Wendy Driver, the white working-class girl. And it didn't seem to have a pattern by class or by race. It was some of the families were fine and some of them weren't. So in the 7-Up movies, he's now at 49-Up or whatever. He lost a lot of people,
sure.
Like if you follow it over time. So I think it's very unlikely that I would do anything. But now they're like 25 or 26. There's an afterword on the last page, which shows where they are now.
Okay.
And now more or less their lives are set. And the middle class kids are mostly in professional jobs. And the working class, none of the really the working class or poor kids made it into the professional arena. And they're working, but they're working like as waiters or as house painters. Wendy Driver's married to a guy who's in the military. So their life chances are just really different now at this point. I don't really think that that is going to change. They might, the working class and poor kids might end up with more health problems earlier if you followed them over time.
Sure.
But I think it's likely that the die is cast at this point.
That's pretty fascinating.
And before we started recording, you had said earlier that... So just tell me again, the kids in the middle class seemed older when they were...
When they were little. When they were 10 years old, as I describe in the book, the middle class kids were kind of blasé. They were easily bored. They complained about being bored a lot, even though they had a lot of organized activities. And they would say, "Mom, I'm bored," like it was Mom's problem to fix this, you know. And the working class and poor kids had very few organized activities, if they had any. And they had much more time to fill, but they almost never complained about being bored. And in organized activities, which were very rare in the working class and poor kids' life, for example, if there was a concert at the school, a spring concert, the middle class kids looked kind of bored on stage, and they looked older. And like if there was a pizza party after an event, the middle class kids didn't seem very excited. But the working class and poor kids looked very excited over like the spring concert, and they'd be bouncing up and down on stage. They looked younger. And at the pizza party, they'd be really excited. We had a pizza party at the end of each of our visits as an exit party with a cake, a bakery cake. And the middle-class kids, it wasn't that special for them because they had pizza all the time. The working-class kids were very excited about it. But then 10 years later, it was different because the working-class kids often had been working sometimes since they were 14, Harold McAllister, black poor kid, or they had car payments, they were working, or they were unemployed, and they seemed, some of them had kids, Katie Brindle had kids, Wendy Driver had kids, so they seemed kind of older and worn. They were still hopeful, but they were older. And the middle class kids were in college, and they were hoping to travel, and they seemed younger. As if they had, so the pattern that when they were 10 years old, the pattern had been reversed.
We also know that you're in the process of writing a book on qualitative research. Can you tell us a little more about that as well?
I am writing a book on ethnography that I'm excited about, and it's a practical guide to ethnography. And so the idea is that when you do ethnographic research, which I think is very valuable, this participant observation is extremely valuable. But I think you need both a combination of dreaming what's your goal in life, what do you want to do, even if it seems really hard, like following around a professional sports team. I mean, I wouldn't give it up. Like when I was doing Unequal Childhoods, people told me it couldn't be done. They said flat out, no one will ever agree. And so I was worried about it, but I really wanted to do it, and I tried to do it. The project is very ambitious. It's not a role model for graduate students. So, you know, I think a graduate student project should be much smaller, maybe 9 months of participant observation and maybe 15 or 20 interviews. So Unequal Childhoods was sort of crazy how ambitious it was, and it was too big, really. Like now, it would be nice to go by and see the families 3 or 4 times a year, have a beer, bring a present for the kid's birthday. But there are 12 families, and even if I didn't go to all of them, but at some level, it was too many families for me to keep up with. So I send a Christmas card every year, but that's it. But that felt bad at the time, like keeping up with them was hard. So I would have a more manageable project, but I think also there are practical guides, like what to wear, what like always eat, always bring food. Like I bring pies, but because I like desserts, but to an interviews and lots of, but anything would work, you know, a bottle of wine, a basket of green apples. You're trying to warm up the interaction. So I think you have to know when do the details matter and when do they don't matter. And I think if you're going to do ethnographic study, it's important to do it close to home, and you have a way to get there. You have to have a bicycle or a car, and you have to be able to get there all the time. So I don't think it's a good idea to do a project all the way across the country if you're going to do an ethnography. So I think it's, so the practical guide to ethnography that I'm writing is about how to do ethnography and also what to worry about and what not to worry about. Because there's something chaotic about ethnography for everybody. And there's a lot of uncertainty and you don't really quite know what you're doing and you're often very confused. And that's appropriate to be confused. But I think it's also important to try to figure out who you are, what you're doing in the field, why you're there, and what you, if you can have a role model for a study you admire by someone, then that gives you kind of like a North Star, something you're gunning, something you're aiming for. It may not be exactly, but it gives you a sort of a sense of what kind of study you'd like this to be one day, if all goes well.
Great. Thanks.
So was the original intention of writing this book, did you see this, that this kind of guide didn't exist in the social sciences, that people doing ethnographies didn't have a place to go?
There wasn't enough attention. There are a growing number of books, and there are a lot of very fine books. When I wrote in my first book, Home Advantage, I have a long, very confessional appendix. And there were some. William F. White has a very good one in Street Corner Society that's used in many courses. But I felt that some books have kind of a smug tone. They say, well, I went in, I built rapport, and I wrote my... I mean, they act like everything went smoothly. And the reality is, it doesn't usually go smoothly. There are always bumps. There are always problems. And I thought sometimes people weren't giving enough of a realistic picture of how difficult and challenging ethnography can be. And so I'd like to put in my two cents on the topic.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking with us, Professor Leroy.
Thank you for having me.
We look forward to your talk tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Great.
Another Office Hours draws to a close. Thanks so much for listening and for spreading the word about Office Hours and the Society Pages to all your friends, family, and colleagues. You've been doing that, right? Right? That's what I thought. See you again soon.